Welcome to the Personal Financial Planning Section podcast, delivering insights from experts on tax, retirement, estate, risk management, investment planning, and practice management, designed to help you best serve your clients and take your practice to the next level. I'm your PFP section host, Sarah Bradley. Be sure to visit us at aicpa.org/PFP and stay tuned at the end of the episode for information on how to access valuable resources. And now over to our guests.
Thank you, Sarah. I'm Michael Goodman, and I'm here to talk about succession planning. I'm super excited today because we're really lucky to have this first guest kicking off our series here on succession planning, and that's David DeVoe of DeVoe & Company. David's been running an investment banking and consulting firm, DeVoe & Company, for 5 years now, but has many years prior to that experience in working with advisors and helping them with succession planning. David, thanks so much for being here today.
It's my pleasure, Michael. Thanks for having me.
So instead of reading about your bio and things like that, I think a great way to kick it off is to talk a little bit about the experiences you've had. You know, what are some things that people can see in your bio that are going to be helpful in understanding what you know and what you bring to the table from the practitioner's perspective on succession planning?
Yeah, well, I guess a few layers. One is I've been an entrepreneur a couple times now. During my senior year of college, I started a company, and that was the first of several very small companies that I ran. So I know the pressure and the reality of P&L and hiring and firing and all that. And after business school, I took the first of two business strategy positions. So joined a group at American Express, a bunch of former McKinsey folks, and really gained a really classical training on business strategy. But perhaps most importantly is just being part of the RIA community for the last, I think it's almost 15 years now. So working in a major custodian strategy project I worked on was whether or not it would be valuable for that company to support its 6,000 plus advisors with a platform to help them with mergers and acquisitions and succession planning. And once the management team decided to move forward with that, they asked me to launch that platform. So literally 14 plus years working directly with advisors, helping them think through these critical business issues and doing what I can to help this community put succession plans in place.
That's great. What a broad background of experience, not only from working with advisors for the last 14 years, but more importantly, I think, is the understanding, like you said, of the P&L and the pressures and responsibilities that come along with running that. So much has changed in the financial services industry in so many different ways. We could talk about that alone on this conversation. But tell us how succession planning has changed over the last 15 years or so.
I think it's a good news, bad news story. You know, when I started here in the community 14 plus years ago, it was probably about 25% of advisors had a written succession plan that was in place. The good news is it's moved in a positive direction. The bad news is it's still right around 30%. And that's created an exposure point for the industry. You know, 70% of firms not having a written succession plan in place, especially given the demographics of this industry. You know, the average age of owners is probably around 61 years old. There's not great data on that, so Lilly reports 51, but that's for advisors in general. For the owners of RIAs, we do have aging demographics. So, you know, it is a concern of mine that, and I think others, that our industry doesn't have the amount of succession plans in place that we need to have. Now, the good news is, you know, when I started in this business, advisors would say, you know, hey, my succession plan is I'm going to die with my boots on. Clearly not a very fiduciary thing to do. Your clients, I imagine my little grandma getting a letter in the mail, you know, in her 80s that says, hey, your advisor ended up dying with his boots on and now you're off on your own. That's not very client-centric. So the good news is I think that has shifted. And most advisors now realize that it is part of their responsibilities to their client to have a buy-sell, to have a succession plan in place. It's just we need more of them to really implement these plans.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that because I think that there's been a pretty good job of the press, perhaps within our profession, as well as conferences, putting this on the agenda. and getting it out there that it's needed. So I think more and more people are aware, more and more advisors are aware that succession planning is something we need to work on. Yet there still seems to be this extremely low acceptance of actually putting it into place. What are the top three, or take it any way you'd like to answer this, but what are some of the primary reasons you think that the adoption of a formal succession plan is so low?
For years, I assumed there was one culprit, but I think I now realize that there's probably a second, perhaps even more important one. Just psychologically, the concept of succession planning for an advisor can be a slippery slope. From, gee, I need to put a succession plan in place, and while that includes a lot of change, I'm going to have to migrate some responsibilities over to the next gen. Right behind that means, I guess, retirement. And I need to start thinking about retirement, which is a whole nother set of changes to one's life. And oh, by the way, you keep going down that slippery slope and you're going from succession to retirement to death. And I think in many cases, firms are like, wow, that's a lot. I'm just going to kick this can further down the road and I'll tackle that next month, which ended up being next year, the following year, just sort of went into the future. But I think there's another component to what's happening, and that's just complexity to this equation. You know, if you start thinking about the elements that can be involved in succession planning, it becomes complicated pretty quickly, right? You need to think through that succession plan and whether you have the right people in place, or gee, maybe you need to hire people, or wow, maybe you should be selling or merging or acquiring your successor. You know, once you determine what that plan is, you need to figure out valuation and deal structure, and gee, maybe even amending this shareholder agreement that you drafted 15 or 20 years ago when you were winging it, and now you have a bigger organization, and that should really be updated. And I guess we need to think through governance, and if you're a shareholder, what decisions you can make. I mean, the list goes on. How do I migrate my client and management responsibilities, all these different things. So it can become overwhelming really quickly. And that's really how we started changing our business. I mean, we do investment banking, helping firms buy, sell, and merge. We do a lot of consulting firms work to help firms run better, and we do a lot of valuation work. But we took the time to realize that this is a big problem and really create a path to help advisors navigate these waters. So advisor A may need like 5 or 6 of these different modules I just ticked through. There's probably about 30 plus. Advisor B needs these 3 or 4. Advisor C needs a different set. So whether folks, can just roll up their sleeves and figure out which one of these things they need to tackle or work with a firm like ours to help navigate that, I think that can alleviate some of these anxieties and help advisors get the plan in place. So, making the complex simple is one of the key steps that will help folks implement a plan.
Gotcha. As kind of a follow-up question to that, I'm sitting here wondering, in the industry, there is certainly a growing number of big firms and regional firms and such, but the industry seems to be made up primarily of smaller firms, 1, 2, 3, 4 people shops, maybe. Mm-hmm. And yeah. I'm wondering if that is a factor, and also the fact that in the profession, there's still not, say, a standardization within the financial planning delivery model, as perhaps mm-hmm. in the accounting world or the law firm world, just to use those as professional services examples. And mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you see as A, that there's just these smaller shops that frankly just don't have the knowledge, capacity, time, bandwidth, et cetera, to deal with it, and or if the lack of replication, the similar replication of delivery model, are those major reasons for this, or is it more the form of the things that you were talking about?
I think you're spot on in a couple in everything you said. You know, this industry is a pyramid. If you think about the numbers, there's several hundred firms that have over $1 billion. There's thousands and thousands and thousands that have under 100 million to the tune of 4,000, 5,000 actually. Depending on the size, it has that pyramid structure. If you're a very small firm, I've been in that chair. Your chief bottle washer is as well as the head of strategy and the head of HR and technology and everything else. So it can become a little overwhelming. Matter of fact, when you're under that $100 million mark, it's often that you haven't what I call crossed the chasm to hire someone that is capable of running your organization, right? You know, that chasm is, wow, I'm going to write a check, $150,000, say, a year, to bring on someone. And, you know, that's a big step for some firms to make. So if you are a sole practitioner, you have a different set of needs, challenges, characteristics than if you are, you know, if you've hired one or two or three, which could be the next gen. So part of it is, yeah, time, energy, just the bandwidth to get this done. And you know, my reaction is, you know what, it just needs to get done. You're a planner. You're helping your clients with this. You are hurting your organization until you put this plan in place. As a matter of fact, I think, you know, at the other end of the continuum, I know Beth Gamble is going to be on one of these calls, and she's a wonderful, wonderful person. And part of her succession plan was merging with another organization. And I think, you know, you'll hear from her, but that unlocks so much more power within that combined organization. I think not only her feeling more energized about what she's doing, but, you know, the next generation being able to take on more responsibility. So, you know, whether you're at the larger end of the continuum and you're putting a plan in place that can have this ripple effect, or you're at the smaller end of the continuum and you just realize you got to bear down and put this buy-sell agreement in place or put that succession plan in place, it can unlock a lot of value and power. As a matter of fact, what we see is when sole practitioners articulate to their clients that they do have a buy-sell agreement in place, they've found someone, to your point, that has the same investment philosophy, has the same client service philosophy. You know, you are right. There is some puzzle pieces that have to come together here if you are going to do a buy-sell or merger. Once those advisors are able to communicate to their clients that they do have a plan in place, or better yet, a successor, we see growth increase because those clients then are more likely to make referrals to that organization. So it can really actually breathe a new level of life into this organization that's already running well. It just can run better.
Yeah, I can see that having a plan in place is going to give you some advantages that are numerous. Let's talk about that for a second and give us a sense of, for somebody who's looking to do that first step, since we're probably talking to 70% of the listeners out there, right? So what are some of the things that are involved in getting that plan in place and getting started? You know, what's involved?
Yeah, I'd say, you know, you can almost lay it out. Like tomorrow morning, just literally tomorrow morning, go get insurance in case you get hit by a bus. You know, your family's taken care of. So that could be number one. The second phase is, you know, is to start thinking through a buy-sell agreement. So, gee, do you know someone that, you know, shares your investment philosophy, your client service philosophy? That person, that firm, could be a good candidate to create this buy-sell agreement. And in some cases, too, there's national firms that, you know, that are actually have created a line of business so that they have these continuity plans in place. They're multi-billion-dollar firms, and they say, hey, if you get hit by a bus, we can run your business for you, et cetera. So that buy-sell agreement, which oftentimes can be changed or eliminated with a pen stroke, you know, they're easy to get out of, but at least putting that in place so that you can start sleeping it better at night as you think through a more comprehensive succession plan. As you think through, gee, maybe merging into another firm or selling into another firm, if you don't have a successor in place, you know, could be the best plan. So a lot of our clients that come to us to solve succession, in many cases, they already have a buy-sell agreement with some organization, an emergency plan, but now it's time for them to really take a deeper breath, start to go through the strategic work, thinking through your goals and objectives and not just your business goals, but your personal goals and really finding that optimal comprehensive plan that's going to be best.
Yeah, I can see in a lot of ways working with an advisor like yourself would be helpful, just like we work with end clients, because we start out with what are your goals? What are you trying to achieve? And I'd imagine that allows somebody like yourself to not only coach and lay out options, but it also allows the practitioner to have a better sense of where they want to go, which will result in a much greater confidence towards moving to succession planning. Is that something that you've been surprised at in working with? Like initially, the practitioner is not, don't ask me about my goals. That's not your job. You know, you're supposed to help me do a succession plan with them. They might fight you initially. But has that been a surprise to you how working through that with practitioners has helped process? And what's that been like for you?
It's great. I love solving complex problems. I love working with really smart people. And that's just been a boon for this industry because, you know, you don't get into this type of work doing wealth management if, you know, you don't have a lot of intellectual horsepower. So that's the good news. And I guess the way we add value is, as you said, very similar to an advisor. So a lot of wealth managers, they work with really smart clients who could probably figure this stuff out, how to manage their portfolios and how to do financial planning. They had all the time in the world, but they don't. So they come to a wealth manager and they say, hey, help me think through this for you. Same thing with us. You know, all of our clients could ultimately figure this out themselves, but they don't. Matter of fact, it's pretty funny. I have one client, and he came to me. He's a great guy. I know him well, but he literally said, look, Dave, you're a smart guy, but I know I'm smarter than you, and I could figure this all out myself, but I want to hire you. Because I know if I write a check, literally, he said this, I know if I write a check, I'm going to get this thing done. And you're going to guide me through the process. And you're going to hold me accountable to get this thing completed. And I have to do this, Dave, because I've stepped into this batter box 3 times over the last 5 years trying to put my succession plan in place. And I still don't have one. This is irresponsible. So, you know, tongue in cheek, you know, he's giving me a hard time. But that's part of our value add. You know, sure, you can wing it yourself and cobble it together. And you know, there's a lot of resources out there, custodians and third parties. And, you know, in sessions like this, there's a lot of information out there. But many advisors are like, hey, you know, let's work with an expert. G. DeBone Company, Dave's been doing this for 15 years. He's worked with hundreds or even thousands of clients. He's seen it all, and he can help, you know, tailor make something for me. I also, you know, I say, sure, I've worked with tons and tons of advisors. I've seen so many different ways. We have a tool shed with all these tools in place. But part of our value add is just structured thinking. You know, you're climbing Mount Everest. We're your Sherpa. We know that, you know, you got to get to base camp. To get to base camp, you need to do these things. The next steps are going to be to do those things. Hey, your firm doesn't need these elements. Let's not spend time on that. But these are critically important based on what your needs are. So you're spot on. We start with the goals and objectives. We start to tailor what's important to that firm. And then we create a nice, efficient path for them to get this completed so they can have all the value of this, but then move on to their day job and focus on what they do best, which is serving clients.
That makes a lot of sense, David. I understand and can see why that would be really helpful. It's interesting here in the financial planning business tied to CPA firms. So we have a lot of CPA-affiliated firms. Some CPAs have now moved on, and all they do is financial planning investment advisory work. But a lot of them are still associated or affiliated back with the original CPA firm. How is that different? Is that harder? Is that easier? What is that like for you in working with firms like that?
It's fascinating. This intersection with CPAs and RAAs, I think, can be so powerful. You know, even back in my custody days, while I was working for a custodian, actually even created a study group with a lot of these firms that had this RAA CPA, because there's not only so much power associated with that, you know, the relationships there and knowing both sides of that equation can be so powerful for clients. But it also can create so much more complexity in some cases, you know, different goals and objectives in the two different camps. So it can create some friction points as well. So I think on a macro level, running the business, it's one of those unique aspects where you want to capitalize on the benefits but try to mitigate and create the most effective working environment that you can. On succession, it creates layers of complexity too. You know, sometimes it's like, okay, how do we create successors that are within our RAA business and they don't do any CPA work? In other cases, you're thinking through, okay, how do we create equity that can be migrated over to the next gen? And in some cases, that requires severing some of the equity with the CPA organization. So I think overall, the CPA/RAA combination is really powerful But you are spot on that it does create a new layer of complexity in most cases.
Great. That's really helpful. Tell us a little bit about working with internal succession versus external succession, and if there's major differences in how you go about that engagement and what that might be like if somebody's maybe focused on, you know, only working with internal, but you want to try to enlighten them to the options externally as well. So how do those contrast, and how do you deal with that with practitioners?
I think you're spot on. There's some consultants, quote unquote, out there that are really investment bankers and consulting clothing, and every solution leads to, and you should sell externally because that's really what they do day to day. That's just, you know, very different from what we do. I mean, our consulting business is as big or bigger than our investment banking business. And you know my wiring. We just talked about. I'm a classically trained strategy consultant. We talk about our business as being really goal-based consulting as well. So, you know, one of the great things that I love about this industry is most advisors want to and aspire and seek and achieve in internal succession. They want these folks that they hired, that they've coached. They want these individuals that are part of their organization to sustain this into the future. It's not just independence and they want to stay independent. You know, there's this affinity to the employees, in many cases almost feel like family. So I think that's a wonderful thing. One of the challenges, you know, that can be faced is these firms, it can become so successful that if you don't start this process early enough, if you don't start migrating equity early enough, then these firms can become so valuable that it becomes a challenge, if not impossible, to sell internally. So, you know, one key takeaway is start this process now, because before you know it, the company's just worth so much money, and then there's another challenging decision. But yeah, I think overall, you know, I'm from California, so I joke I can use these both Buddhist concepts, but there's the concept of beginner's mind, actually called Shoshin, which we encourage advisors to do. You know, start with your goals and objectives, not just business. We encourage them to think professionally. What do you like doing? What are you good at? What do you want to do more of or less of? Even think personally, you know, what do you want to achieve with your life? When do you want to retire? What does retirement look like? Is that stopping on a given Friday or starting to dial it back? You know, 4 days a week, 3 days a week, whatever. Like, just self-awareness. And even on the economic side, you know, how important are the economics, or what economics are most important to you? But by starting with those goals and objectives, what do you really seek to achieve, you or your principal team? Then you're in a position to have that beginner's mind and look at, okay, internal, how does that best achieve these goals and objectives? You know, selling externally, you know, gee, that does or doesn't achieve these goals. Maybe a merger or bringing in a smaller firm that's run by someone, you know, that can run the bigger firm that you have. So these are all different options. It's not that one's better than another broadly. It's just some of these are better than others for a given firm. But by efficiently doing that, then you're in a position to really focus on that specific solution or solution set that is best for your firm. You know, and that's the right way to do it. But the wrong way is, gee, my buddy Bob or Lisa, they recently went through this. I should just go and get their notebook and sort of do what they did. You know, those are different people. Those are different firms. It's probably not going to apply very effectively. Instead, really thinking through what's most important to you and then creating that path. You know, specifically, whether it's internal or external, there's so many building blocks that are the same, right? You know, you sell internally or externally, guess what? You need a valuation. You sell internally or externally, there's going to be some sort of deal structure. How's this going to be financed? What's the down payment, et cetera? You know, governance, how this thing is going to be run, all these different things. So the good news is those building blocks, the components, many of them that are going to apply to both, are going to, you know, you can get smart quickly on both of them simultaneously. So at least an overlap on that element.
Wonderful. That's very helpful. I think that just because we're running out of time, I'm going to ask you if you could to just leave us with one, if there was one thing, what's the most important piece of advice, piece of information you can give our listeners today, what would that be?
I'd say the number one thing is engage with this. Get started and get started today. You know, this is an exposure point, you know, for the industry overall. That's important for us to consider. But if you don't have a succession plan for your firm, this is truly an exposure point for your organization. And sure, it can be some work. It takes time, energy, sometimes money as well. But it's a critical gap to close. And I assure you, going through this process, putting that succession plan in place, will not just check a box, a critical box that needs to be, you know, be put in place, but this will literally unlock so much value for your organization, well outside of having a buy-sell agreement or an emergency plan or a succession plan. This process will enable you to take your organization and even your personal life, I believe, to the next level. So my one piece of advice, you know, please get started on this tomorrow morning.
Well, somebody who's actually taken that first step and gotten started and built out a succession plan, I can be that testimonial and say, you're right, because not only do I feel better as a founder for having done that, these steps towards the succession plan and taken action on many of these steps, but I also feel that the firm is better. Not only the firm is from a sense of value, but also a firm is in our team here. The team here feels better about it. And then ultimately, our clients are way better off knowing that there's a succession plan in place. There's frankly even a comfort zone that develops within the clients as they see that happen. And it creates a better institutional element, even in a small family feeling firm. So I would say, right on, David. I agree. So thank you very much, David DeVoe, DeVoe & Company. Really appreciate you helping out today with us and the members of the AICPA. It's been a wonderful time with you.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
On behalf of the PFP section, this has been Michael Goodman. If you enjoyed this podcast, I highly encourage you to visit the PFP section website and access more practice management and succession planning resources. Stay tuned for Sarah Bradley, who will tell you how to find these valuable resources. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for sharing with our community of listeners. Want more information, resources, tools, and guidance on technical and practice management topics? Visit AICPA.org/PFP and check out the show notes for this episode as well. So if you're not already a member, think about joining the PFP section, which is designed to save you time, help you best serve your clients, and take your financial planning practice to the next level. You'll gain access to a robust selection of high-quality technical and practice management resources like guides, 24/7 access to an online learning library, client communication and education tools, up to 8 hours of free CPE, and more. Don't forget to leave us a review so we can continue bringing valuable and relevant content. And subscribe to our podcast channel so you don't miss an episode. Thanks for listening, and I look forward to next time.
This podcast is designed to provide illustrative information with respect to the subject matter covered and does not represent an official opinion or position of the AICPA or AICPA.org. It is provided with the understanding that the AICPA and AICPA.org are not engaged in offering legal, accounting, or other professional service. If such advice or expert assistance is required, the services of a competent professional person should be sought. The AICPA and AICPA.org make no representations, warranties, or guarantees as to, and assume no responsibility for, the content or application of the material contained herein, and especially disclaim all liability for any damages arising out of the use of, reference to, or reliance on such material.